Hi, I'm Costa Constanti. Welcome to Terra Nullius Cyprus podcast. Here I am in lovely Sydney, Australia, and I'm in the University of Sydney's main campus, and I'm here with Dr. Craig Barker, who is, in my view, an honorary Cypriot, but he's based here in Sydney. And where are we right now?
Oh, thanks for having me on, Costa. But we're in the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney, which is home to the university's museum collection. Mm-hmm. We have more than 450,000 items representing visual arts, archaeology, natural history, Aboriginal Australian material culture, scientific instruments, historic photography, basically everything that a university can collect over 150 years. And this is a new purpose-built museum which is designed to integrate the public with the profession of the university, and a chance for us to show off this collection, to show off our research. And excitingly, Cyprus is part of the overall story here.
Well, I have to say that I'm very impressed. I have to say thank you, first of all, for taking me on a privé tour of the museum, the Chow Chak Wing Museum here in Sydney at the university. I am super impressed. And as I mentioned to Dr. Barker earlier, it takes a lot to impress me, having visited so many museums, so many archaeological sites, so many different galleries around the world. This place has it all. It is a modern museum. It's got the world's best architecture. The lighting is spectacular. The collection is fascinating, from ancient Cyprus to ancient Indigenous Australian culture, which is embedded throughout the museum. I really loved what you mentioned to me earlier, that every level has something Indigenous to it to tie in the collection. And I think that's marvellous. And at the moment, it's the Biennale.
The Sydney Biennale. Mm-hmm. So just like the Venice one every 2 years, but always with an Australian and Pacific focus. Mm-hmm. It's the first time that the University of Sydney has been a partner of the Sydney Biennale. Yep. And so that's been very exciting, having a range of contemporary artists in the space. And it's also been lovely because it's brought new audiences into the museum as well.
Yeah, I can imagine. And I mean, it is free entry, which is marvellous. It's accessible to all. For anyone visiting Sydney, I definitely highly recommend it. It's close to the centre of the city. And it really is worth a visit. I mean, like I said, I've been to so many archaeological museums in Europe and the Middle East, and this really is punching up there with the best of the best. So I'm very impressed. The presentation, the setup of the rooms and the collection is world-class, outstanding. So I'm very impressed. I don't want to give away too much because I'd rather people come and see it for themselves.
Oh, thank you.
But look, I'm particularly interested in you because we've met before in Cyprus, in the Republic of Bafos, to be specific. Now, what you are doing there and your team is marvelous. I'm going to let you tell the listener how you discovered Cyprus, because you discovered Cyprus. Yeah. How you discovered Cyprus, what Cyprus means to you, what you're doing there. Hit the road, all yours.
Well, look, I guess my first trip to Cyprus was when I was 21. Mm-hmm. And it was the very first season of the University of Sydney's excavations at Kata Paphos, ancient Near Paphos, a site that we've been working on since 1995. Mm-hmm. I, at the time, didn't realise that my entire adult life would be measured against those experiences in Cyprus. Yep. Paphos and Cyprus more generally has become my second home. What's been lovely was that the project was always set up to be a training excavation for students. So, I mean, I went that first season when I was an honours student and went on to write my doctorate and, of course, then have a career in archaeology and in museums. Mm-hmm. But there's been subsequent generations of Australian archaeologists. Many of them have gone to work in the Mediterranean, but many work on Australian sites.
Yep.
But there's always been a little bit of Cyprus in the work that they've done.
Yep.
And I think what's lovely about our project, because I think what I find when I go to Cyprus, also when I'm traveling through Europe, that people are often surprised that Australians are involved in archaeology in the Mediterranean region. Yeah. And the question I often get is, you know, why have you come so far to study our culture? Because it's fascinating. Why would we not? But there's a long tradition of Australians working on the island. That's right. I see myself very much as the inheritor and part of the, you know, trying to pass the baton on
or
to the torchbearer. The torchbearer, yes. So
who was, just to cut you off, who was the first Australian archaeologist in Cyprus that's well known?
So look, it really begins with a man called James Stewart. Mm-hmm. He was born here in Sydney. He was educated at Cambridge University in the 1930s. Mm-hmm. And he and his first wife, whilst being based in Ankara, travelled via Cyprus. Of course, it was a British colony at the time. And basically fell in love with the island. And so I sort of see a lot of parallels in the way that my own personal journey has been. But in 1938, James and Eleanor, the first wife, ran an excavation at a site called Vurnos on the north of the island. This is a very, very important cemetery site of the early Bronze Age. If you go to the Cyprus Museum, you'll see material from Vurnos. But if you go to any museum collection around the world that has early Cypriot material in it, the Vurnos Cemetery is there as well. So it was excavated by Cypriots, it was excavated by a French team, and then the Aussies had a go. And it was technically a British excavation, but it was the first time an Australian led a scientific excavation in the Mediterranean region. And I think had World War II not have occurred, Stewart probably would have ended up having a career in Britain. But he served he served with the Cyprus Regiment, actually, and was taken prisoner of war by the Germans in the Battle of Crete. And spent much of the war in various prisoner of war camps writing archaeological reports.
At the time,
and,
I guess.
And actually, I mean, teaching other other prisoners of war about the archaeology of Cyprus. So we always joke about, you know, academics love captive audiences. He literally had a captive audience. But, really fascinating man. After the war, he is offered a position here at the University of Sydney, which he takes up. And he and a man called Professor Dale Trendall end up establishing the first ever Department of Archaeology in Australia. And they had wild ambitions, which was that Cyprus would be the centre of an Australian fieldwork project working all over the Eastern Mediterranean. And his second wife, Jim Stewart's second wife, actually owned property on the north of the island. So that would become the dig house for all of these projects in Egypt, in Jordan, in Turkey. And, of course, both world politics and university politics and personal politics meant that this didn't quite play out. But in the 1950s, the University of Sydney was involved with financing a number of excavations in Cyprus, and then Jim Stewart and his second wife, Eve, ran a number of digs in Nicosia, in Visalia, in the north of the island, and then just before he died in 1962, an excavation at a place called Kami. So
this is actually where my maternal grandmother's from.
That's right, yes, yes, yes. So, and again, another very important cemetery site because one of the graves, one of the tombs, actually had a human figure carved in relief in the entrance.
In Kami?
Yes. Oh, right. Yes, yes. So it's one of the earliest relief statue, or one of the earliest relief depictions of the human form on the island.
Okay.
So it's really significant contribution. And in many ways, what's more important, because he died young, he was only 49 when he passed away, but what Stewart had done was to set up the tradition of teaching archaeology in Australia, and Cyprus would be at the centre of that. And so whilst the University of Sydney wasn't to return to Cyprus for a number of decades, you had other Australian, Basil Hennessy, David Frankel, Jenny Webb, who's still incredibly active on the island. And then again, through their students, people like Lindy Crewe and, you know, whole, you know, multiple generations. Robert Merrilies was a student of Jim Stewart's, who went on and had a very distinguished career in Australian diplomacy.
And he actually, I had the honour of giving him a modern day tour of the north coast of the island, where he revisited some of the sites he had worked on near Flamouthi and Kadami and whatnot. So it's quite, it always, for me as a Cypriot Australian, it was fascinating visiting sites from before the division of the island and talking about archaeology, which goes back thousands of years, with somebody like Dr. Merrilies, who was in diplomacy where I was working. So there were so many parallels. And I mean, I loved it. And I, and every time we visit Cyprus, we catch up. And I mean, I find the man fascinating. He is, again, another beacon of Australian, Australian-Cyprus relations, you know. But you mentioned that Eve, the second wife of Jim Stewart, had property in the north. She wasn't Cypriot, though, was she?
No. So she was British. Her father was an engineer working on the island, and bought a house, which ironically had been owned previously by a pioneering female archaeologist who worked in the Pacific.
Huh.
And she too died tragically young. But interestingly, Eve managed to find within the property in Cyprus a whole lot of her records.
Oh, wow.
So again, these sort of Pacific Mediterranean connections just kept on playing upon one another.
Island to island.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, it's kind of interesting that on paper, Cyprus and Australia have nothing in common.
Mm.
But when you break it down, both former colonies of the British Empire, both were peoples with a very similar sense of humour and attitude towards life.
Definitely.
They're
two of the most sarcastic places on earth. So a Cypriot Australian is uber sarcastic. Yes.
Very much so.
But both being islands as well have had seafarers and discoverers and settlers and whatnot coming in by sea.
And there's also that sense of different periods of history and different influences coming into both of their countries. So again, you know, we're talking earlier before about, you know, that recognition of the 60,000 plus years of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Australia that we're only just beginning to understand.
Correct.
What we now call deep time, that deep connection with land. But it wasn't like Aboriginal people arrived. There were waves of people coming in. The dingo, the famous Australian dog, for example, we know was introduced to Australia 4,000 years ago. So there were people coming in. There were traders coming in from Indonesia and so on. And then, of course, once you've got European settlement, and there's still very much this attitude that sort of colonial New South Wales, colonial Australia was just British. But there were people coming from all over the world, including Greece, including eventually Cyprus by the late 19th century. With each of those waves of migration, you're getting a new Australia each time.
Yes.
And I think that's a good way to think about Cyprus history as well, that you've got, you know, Egyptian influences and Middle Eastern influences and Greek influences and Roman influences and Crusader influences and Venetian influences and Ottoman influences. But at each stage, it's always Cypriot.
Yes.
It's always distinct.
The Cypriotness survives through all levels of the tapestry.
And obviously there are aspects of Hellenization and there are aspects of Middle Eastern food and, of course, language being one of the great indicators of who people were. And archaeologically, it's often things like burial practices and you know, patterns in pottery or patterns in weaving and so on. But what you've got is always this really amazing ability of the local Cypriot artisans to take all of these things from around and to make it theirs, to make it distinctively theirs.
That what you just touched on there, make it theirs, I find interesting, because I think I'm seeing this in Australia now, where Indigenous culture, when I was growing up, I'm now nearly 44, and Indigenous culture was such a foreign concept to me as a child. Now we're starting to see it permeating in all levels of Australian society, history, education, and it's becoming ours. So the First Nations versus New Australians, and it's bleeding together. Well overdue. But like in Cyprus, I like how this merging of cultures, tangible historical pastimes, brought in with the modern contemporary era. And I don't think people have understood the bridging of the two as much as they should.
No. And that's, in the case of Australia, that's been possible because of two things. One has been the generosity of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people to share a lot of their knowledge that they may not necessarily, you know, it's very difficult to do that with let's face it, you know, invaders.
Yeah.
But then secondly, gradually an awareness amongst broader Australian culture to begin to listen to those stories.
Yes.
Because for a long time, and this is what you alluded to, likewise when I was a child, that, you know, we kind of knew that there was Aboriginal Australia and there were boomerangs and things like that, but we were not taught it at school. And now you've had a change. And one of the things about listening is you learn so much new.
Yeah.
And I think what's great is that there are amazing stories from ancient Cyprus that not just modern Cyprus, the modern world can learn from, about actually how to have a functioning society that has all of this international interaction.
Yep.
And how to have a functioning society in which you can still have a distinctive sense of identity, but at the same time working with everyone else as well.
Well, I think it's also a significant indicator of the advancement, intelligence of a society that's able to welcome or receive, maybe not so welcome, but receive a new culture and take from that culture and absorb some of it. Because if a culture sees something coming in and then just blocks it,
yeah,
means that you don't learn anything. I always use the example is olive oil 50 years ago, actually maybe a bit more, about 70, 80 years ago, you could only buy it in a pharmacy in Australia.
Yes, yeah.
You can't imagine Australian cuisine now without olive oil,
yeah,
or without garlic, or without, you know. So, you know, if you were to block everything that comes in, you'll end up being
very simple. Australia attempted this.
Yeah.
For the first half of the 20th century, we had what was called the White Australian Policy.
Correct.
This was a government policy that you could only migrate to Australia if you had European ancestry, or if you could speak a European language was one of the Australian government policies. And famously, there was a case which a young man from the South Pacific who was trained in a whole series of European languages, so he was multilingual, would have been an amazing addition to Australian society. And they gave him the examination in Finnish.
Oh.
Now, find anyone in Australia outside of the Finnish Australian community who could speak Finnish. It was a deliberate attempt to stop that. And, of course, what it actually did was, yes, Australia's demographic population grew, but our cultural engagement stagnated. And that sort of post-World War II period, which predominantly Greek and Italian migrants initially, but then increasingly migrants from other parts of Southern Europe, and then after that, Southeast Asia, after that, China, and more recently from the Middle Eastern world and from now Africa, what you've got is a really vibrant society that if we want to go and have dinner tonight in Sydney,
have anything you want,
choose any part of the world, and even more importantly, the fusion food. So what's a distinctive Australian cuisine, which is a little bit of Thai and a little bit of Greek and a little bit
of Spanish. Funny you mentioned that, because just last night I had dinner at a restaurant in Bondi Beach, and it was marketed as Thai, but it was most certainly a fusion. Like, I didn't identify most of the food I was eating, but it was so good. And everyone always asks me overseas, you know, what's Australian cuisine? And I've gone, well, it's nothing and everything. There's no such thing as Australian cuisine, because it literally is take the world's cuisine, improve it, and mix it.
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't understand what I'm talking about until I give them the example of Peruvian Japanese, which has made it into Europe now.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, who would ever have thought that this Latin American country and an Asian country could merge their cuisine? And yet they have.
Yeah.
And so successfully.
Yeah.
And so that's when I'm like, I see them reacting going, oh, okay. I'm like, so imagine European, Asian, Middle Eastern, African, Latino. Imagine all these cuisines blending into different versions of each other. And they're like, oh. I go, and that's also the tapestry of our culture. To jump back a step to this Indigenous awakening amongst the contemporary Australian population, would you say, and this is my hunch, and I may be wrong, you can correct me, would it be a case of Australians in general yearning for history? Yearning for what, when they travel overseas and they see how ancient the world actually is, they realize that in fact we're even older, and they're trying to engage it maybe a little bit selfishly.
There's potentially a degree of that. I think that what I'm finding, both in terms of my own experience and my own journey, that you know, even as a professional archaeologist, that I'm still finding things about Australian, broader Australian history that were inconceivable when I was a student back in the 1990s. But I think that in general, there's more of a curiosity now to find out. I think that that Australian perspective on how human engagement with landscape, as a more holistic understanding of history, that often in a more traditional European perspective, we think of history as either the great leaders of history, so your Napoleons or your Julius Caesars or wherever, the great man of history tradition, or the architecture. So it's about, you know, the castle or the Vatican or the you know, wherever. What you have, if you think about it logically from an Australian perspective, is this idea of how landscape has changed the way people engage, but then also through things like controlled burning, the way that humans have impacted upon the Australian landscape. And there's that realization that you can't understand the Aboriginal human history without understanding the natural history of this country. They are integrated. So if we go back to Europe or go back to the Mediterranean, I've been trained to think about ancient Cyprus through monument, monument, object, object. Now let's think about that through landscape as well. And that gives a different perspective because, you know, why did they choose to build this particular city in this location? Why did they choose to build these particular structures there? There's a rationale behind where everything is.
So whether it be water sources, observation mounds, or, you know,
defensive, military, religious, practical things, you know, where do you put your farms, shipping and trade. And then, you know, as someone who's excavating a grand public building, the ancient theatre of Paphos, you know, how do you provide the infrastructure to get 8,000 people into the audience and out again? So all of those,
which 8,000 people back then would have been the equivalent of 100,000 today.
Yes, well, it's population dynamics. It's the equivalent of a football stadium, in terms of a big event, society stopping for a big event. So think of a big concert or a big sporting event, and the way that it impacts upon a modern city. And, you know, we see things like Beyonce touring in Sweden and the economy goes up. The same thing happened during drama festivals in the ancient world because
it brought the people in.
Your cousins from remote communities and villages are coming in. They're trading. You're catching up on gossip. The actual theatre is, in many ways, the least important part. It's a communal happening. And that gives a different perspective in terms of the way that ancient societies functioned.
Now, touching on the Paphos Theatre, tell us more about that. What is there? What are we seeing there? Now, I've visited the place, but I'm going to pretend I know nothing about it so our listeners can learn a bit more, because most Cypriots will be aware of Kato Paphos and the mosaic area, but many of them will not be familiar with the Fabrica Hill area.
No.
Tell us a bit more about that.
I think the first thing we need to think about is ancient Neo-Paphos, New Paphos, the city as an entire functioning entity. So we archaeologists tend to sort of work in particular areas and we tend to publish, and so everyone sort of thinks the mosaics are over there and the agora is over there and the theatre is over there. It's all one community.
Now, sorry to interject there. Now, for people who understand Paphos, this area is basically along the harbour and the sea walls and all the way to where the roundabout, where the mall is today,
Yes,
all
right. That is correct. And, of course, this area is all World Heritage listed. It was inscribed in 1980. It was the first site in Cyprus, the first of three listings for the Republic. And so, you know, really an important time in terms of the island's history, but a really important time in terms of understanding the heritage of the island's history that we can touch upon later. But what you have is a city built around a harbour, which was its main rationale, but a city dominated by two large hills. So anyone who's been to Kato Paphos will know the lighthouse. The other hill is called Fabrica. And as you say, it's very close to the Paphos Mall. We now know that there was a lot of architecture on the top of that hill because of our wonderful, wonderful colleagues from Warsaw and from Avignon. We know that there was a Hellenistic temple dedicated to Aphrodite on the top of that hill.
Is that where there's a mosaic?
Very close some of you will know the Kissing Dolphins mosaics, as our students always call it. But and again, it's a very early Hellenistic. This is all very early.
When we say early Hellenistic,
what? So this is the period after Alexander the Great's conquest. So we're looking at the very end of the 300s BC and the beginnings of the 200s BC. And this is when the city of Paphos is traditionally established. All the historical records tell us it's either Nicocles II, the last king of Paphos, moving the administrative capital from Paleopaphos, the modern village of Kuklia, and of course where the grand sanctuary dedicated to the goddess was, moving that to the harbour. Or the alternative ancient historical tradition is it's the Ptolemies, the invaders from Alexandria, seize the island and set up a new city. Who does it doesn't actually really matter. What matters is around here you've got the idea of let's build a new city, let's take advantage of the harbour, and that harbour feeds into international trade routes. So we see that in amphora and architecture and all of the pottery and all the glass and other items are being transported backwards and forwards. The island becomes very rich very quickly, and it's because of international trade. But interestingly, one of the ways you're setting up a brand new city in the wake of Alexander's conquest, you're setting up a Greek city. So it's laid out on what we call a Hippodamian grid plan, very rigid northeast. North, south, east, west.
So like a good old HODL street, HODL grid. Yes.
Well, I mean, it's interesting from a, from an Australian perspective. Sydney is an organic city, which is very unregulated. Many of the roads in Sydney, including Parramatta Road, which is about 200 metres from where we're sitting, is an ancient Aboriginal bush track that's been turned into a highway. And so modern Sydney traffic is chaos because it's not designed. Yeah, 5.5 million cars.
I experienced that last night. Aboriginal bush track.
It was established in 1788.
Right.
Melbourne and Adelaide, the next Australian cities, were established in the 1840s, 1850s. And by this stage, you have European town planning. Paris is a good example. So streets are gridded and regular. So Melbourne, any time a Sydney-sider like myself goes to Melbourne, it's kind of weird because the streets are all the same thing.
And makes sense.
Melbournians come to Sydney and kind of go, what the hell's going on here? But, yeah, that's kind of a modern a modern parallel of that more ancient tradition that the really old cities that have been going forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. So Kittyern becoming Larnaca, for example. But Neopaphos is set up. So it's set up according to all of the contemporary standards. So you build nice flash temples. You have a nice functioning harbour. And to show you're Greek, you build a theatre. So the work uncovered by the Paphos Theatre Archaeological Project from Sydney University, established by my mentor, Professor Richard Green, and now my wonderful team are continuing the work. We know that that theatre, cut into the southern slope of Fabrica Hill, overlooking the ancient city, was used for about 6.5 centuries. As a venue for performance and as a venue for spectacle.
One could only dream of a venue lasting that long these days.
Well, it's interesting. So I am exactly the same age as the Sydney Opera House here.
It's not very old.
Well, it's just celebrated its 50th birthday, so I guess that means I have as well. But what's interesting is that, again, another example of contemporary architecture design. You know, in 1973, it was the is the preeminent example of modernist architecture. The interior of the Sydney Opera House has undergone a number of renovations to make it, because it looks great, but it actually didn't work very well. My wife used to work at the Sydney Opera House, so I've spent a lot of time in there, and you know, it's the green rooms are tiny and things like that. So the Sydney Opera House Trust has done a lot of work to make it function better as a theatre. The same thing happened in antiquity, that as there are changes in contemporary styles of performance, you need to renovate the theatres. And, of course, the other thing, being in Cyprus, is that there are frequent earthquakes. So we know that there are at least six phases of the building being rebuilt, and each time it's rebuilt according to contemporary standards. So the very first theatre probably was quite modest, quite small, might have had a wooden stage and a wooden building. There's very little of that that remains. But in about 150 BC, they built a brand new single-story stage building, which would have been influenced by the architecture of Alexandria in Egypt. And, of course, it's all connected. The Ptolemies, and Cleopatra is the most famous of the Ptolemies, but the Ptolemies out of Alexandria control the island. And so you've got a lot of cultural influence back.
And they would have been sending, I guess, their architects over.
Absolutely. And and probably the same builders. And again, we see this with the Tombs of the Kings just outside of Paphos, which is the same date. So this is contemporary Alexandrian funeral practice. And what's interesting about the Tombs of the Kings is the architecture of parts of the cemetery, not all the cemetery, but parts of the cemetery are very, very Alexandrian. The architecture of other parts of the cemetery are very Paphian. But the way that the people are being buried with their grave goods is very Cypriot. So you've got this interesting thing. And again, this idea of adaptation. It's a fusion. You've got, you know, my beloved family member that dies, we want them buried in the new tradition or the new flash style of architecture, but we want them buried the way that their grandparents were. And so you get an archaeological record of that, that time of transition. And so with the theatre, we then have a renovation following the early Roman earthquake of about 15 BC, an Augustan theatre phase. And then there is a major renovation under the Antonine emperors, Marcus Aurelius and Antoninus Pius. Marcus Aurelius, we will know as the Stoic philosopher, emperor, or from the movie Gladiator. Increasingly, a lot of the work that I've been researching recently is there's a Severan phase. So these are the Severan emperors of the late 2nd century, early 3rd century AD, and we think that the theatre was possibly converted into an arena at that stage. Right. The Roman Emperor Caligula was famous for when he travelled around the empire wanting to see hunting displays.
Okay.
So the local communities would rip out their theatres and turn them into arenas on the off chance that he might pass through. And I think that that may have happened in Paphos. Yeah. And likewise at the theatre at Corian as well.
Okay.
And then eventually towards the end of that century, there's a full conversion of the theatre of Paphos into a venue for spectacle.
Mm-hmm.
We know that the orchestra could have been flooded in that final phase for displays of water displays, possibly, you know, crocodiles from the Nile and things like that, but also girls being dressed up as, you know, dancers dressed up as nymphs and things like that as well.
Is this water theatre common in the ancient Hellenistic Roman world?
It actually is.
It's
very much a Roman development.
Because I knew nothing of this until I visited Vietnam to see water puppetry and all this. And when I first heard that that was happening in Paphos, my uneducated historical mind went to, oh, this must be an Asian influence. I had no idea that this was prevalent in the region.
And of course, many people are unaware the Colosseum in Rome itself could be flooded.
Right.
For reenactment of naval battles. Now, the theatre at Paphos is not large enough for that.
Yeah, yeah.
But in that final phase of the 3rd century AD,
mm-hmm.
It appears to be that it's a venue no longer for putting on plays, but a venue for spectacles.
Okay.
And, of course, there's a devastating earthquake in about 360, or possibly a series of earthquakes over a decade, which knocks the theatre out. And it's combined with a period of transition in broader Roman culture anyway.
Okay.
The rise of Christianity,
mm-hmm.
theatre is seen as a venue for false emotion.
Right.
And instead we should be going to church. And okay. so the economic downturn, although not complete because, of course, we still have wonderful mosaics, Paphos is still rich.
Okay? Yes.
So remains. Part of the town's in ruins from the earthquake and other parts around the Villa of Theseus, they're renovating with new mosaics and new sculptures.
So the mosaics come during the Christian period?
Mosaics begin earlier, but what you have at Paphos is several centuries worth of mosaics representing different houses or indeed even different rooms in the same house being renovated as it undergoes its full transition.
I have a question. When Christianity comes through the region, and I know that they were ripping down pagan temples or converting them into churches, how is it that these theatres weren't turned into very spectacular open-air churches? Or maybe they were?
Well, they could have been.
Okay.
Because also the thing about an open-air theatre, and I'm not going to use the word amphitheatre because there is actually a strict architectural difference in the Roman world. Theatres are semicircular or horseshoe-shaped, and they are venues for performances.
Mm-hmm.
Smaller, more intimate theatres are known as odeons in Greek or auditorium, auditoria in Roman or in Latin. The one in the Paphos Agora. And these are for lyrical poetry recital and for musical performances.
Okay, it's more intimate.
More intimate.
Okay.
An amphitheatre is completely enclosed. It is oval-shaped, and it is a purely Roman invention.
Okay.
The Colosseum, of course, is the most famous, but there were more than 200 built right across the Roman world, and they are primarily for gladiatorial fights or for displays of wild creatures. So Paphos has a theatre, it has an odeon, and has an unexcavated amphitheatre.
Get out.
Now, not even Athens has all three.
This is new to me. Where's this amphitheatre?
So the amphitheatre is very close to the mosaics. If you, if any of our listeners are ever visiting the World Heritage Listed Archaeological Park, if you go off the pathway a little bit, you'll see a great hole in the ground, and that is the location of the amphitheatre. It's not been excavated, but we know the dimensions of it.
Wow.
The dating we debate a little bit, but what you have in this one town is all three venues.
It also gives away how rich this place would have been.
If you want an indication of the wealth of Paphos over a long period of time, those three, these are not necessary. You need a harbour, you need temples.
Correct.
You need a marketplace.
Yes.
You don't need a theatre.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, really. Yeah. It's nice to have one. It's good for the spirit of the community. It's good for the soul. You don't need one.
Well, technically, you don't need temples either. Well, really. You need a marketplace and you need a school. And that's fascinating. So regarding temples, what's the cluster there like? I mean, do we have...
Well, that's what we don't know so much. Okay. So obviously there was there was something on the top of Fabrica, but it's quite early. It seems to have not been functioning after the Antonine phase.
Okay.
So undoubtedly there are other temples located around Paphos that have just not been identified.
Okay.
And it does give you an idea of just how much work there is still to be done. Our wonderful colleagues from Krakow, the Polish mission, have done a lot of work in recent years of underground LIDAR, what's called LIDAR, basically underground, it's almost like a radar system, picking up evidence of architecture under the ground.
All right.
And I think that that's kind of going to give us a roadmap for going forwards.
Okay.
And when I took, again, this idea of integrating, that we can't think of the theatre separate from all of the other urban parts. Our project could have just been about excavating the theatre, but we always wanted it to be more.
Yep.
The first thing, of course, was that we discovered that the theatre was underneath a lot of medieval and post-medieval architecture anyway. Yep. But as we've begun to work outside of the theatre, we've picked up a significant paved road, more than 8.5 metres wide, that would have been the main road, and it would have been colonnaded. So again, that's how you get your audience in and out of the theatre.
Is this the road that passes the Nymphaeum?
Yes, is correct. Yep. So we're also a Nymphaeum, which is a Roman fountain house. Now, the Romans liked building these in the second century all over the Mediterranean, particularly in the east. A, because it provided fresh water and a cooling aspect.
Yep.
So we're very close to the ancient city gates that would have connected Neopaphos with the sanctuary of Aphrodite in Paleopaphos. Yep. So there would have been thousands of pilgrims each year who would have passed through that city gate.
Wow.
You walk in, you know, if you just walk 16 kilometres in the hot Cypriot sun, and you walk through the city gates and suddenly it's cooler and you've got water you can splash in your face.
Oh, that would have been marvellous.
It's
yeah.
a sign for the Romans of domination over nature.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
We can control the water.
Much like Crown Casino Melbourne and their fireballs, you know. Like. So I'm just trying to bring it to the modern day equivalents.
But you do see see the way that that architecture and landscape, as I was saying before, but that that interaction. So the Romans are bringing in water through an aqueduct system that would have come from the village of Tala, right up in the foothills of the Troodos. And that water is supplying the water to the theatre, supplying the waters to the Nymphaeum, but also supplying water, probably through quite a complex distribution network, throughout the rest of the city.
Were there cisterns, if I'm not mistaken, near the mall? There were some evidences of cisterns collecting the water.
Yeah. Yes, yes.
I think they've been lost now.
They're underneath the shopping centre. You can go and visit them. They have been moved, but a number of them have been
preserved. This is to the side of the mall. There's a shelter. Right. Okay, got you. Okay, so that's not actually in situ. That's been moved.
It has been moved, is my understanding.
Oh, wow, what a project. Okay, that's fascinating. Like, I had to come to Sydney to learn more about my...
but again, we've got this in Sydney, we've got it in Melbourne too, the way that modern development, you know, it used to often be thought that archaeology and heritage stopped development and, you know, oh, we don't want to report that we found a tomb because it's just going to bring in those bloody archaeologists and it's going to slow our work. Guess what? You work it into the development. You make it part of the story. It's for tourists. It's for the residents.
It adds so much value to a property. Yeah. I like the Athens Acropolis Museum, where as you walk in at the front there, there's the glass rooftop and you look down at the archaeological digs.
Yes.
I just wish there was more of that across the region because it adds so much value to a property.
It does.
In the old town of Nicosia, I won't give away the address, but a friend of mine has this beautiful old townhouse, and when they're doing a renovation of their floor, they've uncovered some archaeology. So what they've done is, hand in hand with the antiquities department, they've now got a glass floor. Yeah. So whilst they're in their kitchen cooking, they look down on this stone.
That's amazing.
And it's beautiful. And for me, I think it makes the house priceless. Yeah.
See, this is the lesson to be learnt, because I think that we've come out of sort of six decades or so of people thinking, and it's not just Cyprus, it's also here in Australia, it's in other parts. If I find something archaeological, and let's face it, it's impossible to dig a hole in Cyprus and not. But if I find something, it's going to devalue my property and it's going to waste all this time when the archaeologists come and do their work.
Yep.
And actually rethink that conversation because it enhances the value.
Yeah.
And it provides a win for everybody because it has the heritage. Yeah, even if not necessarily preserved, has the heritage studied, and your development can still go ahead.
Let's see it.
Yeah, because I've noticed it's not stopping stuff; it's adapting things.
Correct. It's adding to it and adding value. speaking of Australian archaeology, I was fascinated driving from Melbourne on the Hume Highway to Sydney. It's an 8-hour drive. Near the halfway point, you've got the town of Gundagai, and there's the dog on the tugger box. And of course, you've got to make the stop and take a photo with this.
We should explain, it's a little statue.
Yeah, it's a little statue of a dog. It's basically life-size. It's not a huge thing. I mean, yeah,
a whole lot of Australian songs about it.
Yeah, TV, but it's like the Mona Lisa. A lot of people go there and disappointed to see this tiny little thing. You know, but it's significant in Australian history. Yet when I parked the car and got out, looked at the dog on the tucker box, took my photo, was about to leave, and I looked to the right of the car, and there's literally the Australian equivalent of an archaeological site. And it was an old inn. That's basically the foundations and some of the, well, I'm not sure what stone it is, but it looks like granite slabs, part of the wall are there, and it's been, you know, cordoned off, and there's signage telling you what it is. And I was so fascinated by this. And for me, the stop was all about this site.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought, wow, like, you know, and what's the story here? Basically, people commuting between Melbourne and Sydney 200 years ago or 150 years ago were stopping and spending the nights in this inn.
Yeah.
And now with cars, no one needs to spend the night anymore. You can drive right through. And I thought, how fantastic it is that they've preserved this, because that's a visual representation of the history of the commute between Melbourne and Sydney.
Yep, yeah.
You know, and I think we need more of that in Australia, because we tend to think of archaeology as something that's over 1,000 years old. And it's not the case. No, it can be something just a couple of decades ago. You know?
And I think this is one of the exciting things about working in Paphos, because everyone, you know, and the tourists and, you know, even on our own website, we describe it as the Hellenistic and Roman theatre site. But in many ways, the medieval occupation, the late antiquity occupation, so archaeologically not much is known about what happens in Cyprus in the 8th and 9th centuries.
Okay.
It's kind of a bit of a black hole. We call it the gap centuries.
Okay.
There's been a whole lot of conferences recently, because increasingly archaeologists are beginning to understand more and more about that period. The Paphos Theatre has gap century occupation. It's only very small traces, but we're going to be able to make a major contribution to that. During the period of the Crusades, there is a kiln somewhere on the site. We've yet to find it, but we know it's there because there's all of this associated material with developing glazed pottery.
All right.
The Scrofito ware. So again, walk into any medieval museum in Europe and in the Mediterranean and you'll see Scrofito. Paphos Theatre Scrofito has been found on Crusader sites in Jerusalem in Israel.
Right.
So it's been manufactured on Cyprus, picked up by the Crusaders and taken with them.
Yep.
After that great wealth, you know, again, there's a series of major earthquakes. Sarada Colonna's castle is demolished in one of them, for example. Yep.
On that, this is a castle that was, whilst it was being used, wasn't actually finished, am I right?
Oh, well, the original interpretation was that it was only used for a very short period of time.
Okay.
Increasing reassessment of the site suggests that it might be a little more complex than that.
Okay.
But you are right. Yeah. Ultimately, it was in use for a relatively short period of time as the classic Crusader castle, because it was destroyed by an earthquake.
Yeah. And it's great to visit because you can see the evidence of the earthquake with the columns on this iron and things like that.
See, all those columns are recycled. They're earlier Roman columns that have been incorporated into that architecture. Yeah. So
look, the ancient people of Cyprus and around the world were very good at recycling.
Yeah.
these are some lessons for us today, but
And then, of course, we've got, we now have a medieval and Venetian building and then Ottoman period stuff. And, you know, we've literally got occupation from 300 BC to the 1970s. And indeed, one season we found a cassette tape, which I'm pretty sure was mine as a student as well. So
You've shown me that cassette tape.
So it's kind of funny having your own archaeology.
I hope you've kept that.
Yes, it did actually go into the inventory.
Good, good.
It's too ruined to play again, but I'm positive it's one of the ones I brought. And if it wasn't me, it was one of the other students in 1996 or 7. All jokes aside, you have this layer upon layer upon layer upon layer.
Yeah.
And I think what I'd like people to appreciate is that Cyprus is remarkable in having, you know, across the island, these periods that are built upon, and there are obviously peaks in particular areas and there are particular reasons why at certain times certain areas are thriving and they're not at other times, but overall what you have is this ability to understand 10,000 years of human history in one area, and that's really exciting.
It's incredible. And I think as Cypriots, we need to understand the value of this place, how much it enriches the island, not just touristically, but certainly touristically, but it tells us so much about who we are, where we've been, where we're going.
Yep.
I know that there's debate as to what to do with the site going forward. I personally would hate to see it restored, which I know that there are voices for that, because I think there's enough on the island.
Legally, we can't restore it anyway, even if it was a groundswell for it to be restored. But I know the Department of Antiquities, who ultimately are going to make the decision, don't want to do so, in large part because there are European legislation about restoration of sites. And there are innumerable examples of archaeological sites that were restored. Knossos on Crete is a good example. That what you have is the 1920s concrete that Sir Arthur Evans used for that restoration is now beginning to get cancerous and decay. I'd like to see it all gone. Because it's not the actual Minoan site. It's 20th century. But of course, so many tourists have taken that photograph of that, and for them, that is Knossos. That there's a real challenge. Where increasingly the heritage industry is heading is towards this concept of keeping the site as they were, but using virtual reality and other digital forms of presentation to give a digital recreation.
And that's what we touched on earlier, and some of the work that I'm doing now with Forager International about this whole recreating digitally a site so that you can stand there, look at the site as it is today, which, you know, for all sense of purposes, maybe just rubble on the ground, but you can actually visually see a reconstructed site digitally. And the good thing about doing it that way is that you can always change it as new facts come to life. Like you mentioned with Knossos, recreating it the way it was, or the way they've done it with that little red room and the two, three columns there, it has become imprinted on the tourist mind that that's what Knossos is. But it may not be, and as we know, it not was like that. But it's interesting because it reminds me of when they did the restoration of Apostolos Andreas Monastery at the tip of the island. They wanted initially to remove the upstairs hermitage dormitories and the balconies, which are much newer than the church itself.
Yep.
And the restoration, there was conflict as to, do we restore it to just the church with a normal roof, or do we reincorporate these more modern monastic cells on the roof? In the end, they kept it because it was so embedded in Cypriot modern culture and contemporary memory of the place. They've embedded it. I do believe that they could have left it off and then you could watch it digitally. But, I mean, I'm not the one to decide.
Look, it is a challenge, and any restoration. But I think the key thing is that restoration involves destruction.
Yes.
And it does involve choices with multi-period sites. If you've got a site that was only used for a short period of time, that's where you could do it. But as we've just said, with Cyprus, you've got everything. So with the theatre, for example, if you were to restore it, are you restoring the Hellenistic theatre? Are you restoring the Roman Antonine theatre with all of its marble adornments? So, you know, that's a lot of money. Are you restoring the Roman arena? Are you restoring the medieval village? Are you restoring the Venetian manor house? What are you restoring? Okay.
Yeah.
Because you've got to choose one at the cost of everything else.
Yes.
And I think, you know, if one looks at the other theatre restorations in Cyprus, so Kurion and on the north, Salamis and Sulai, that were all restored in the 1960s. And, you know, you've kind of got in all three cases standard Roman theatres.
Yeah.
But we've now lost the ability to understand the earlier and later histories of those sites.
Yes.
So it's, I'm not necessarily against restoration, but it needs to be done thoughtfully.
And you don't need to do all of them.
You don't need to do all of them.
Yeah, no, that's great. Well, look, I know you're coming back to Cyprus this year.
That's right. Our next season will take place later in the year.
Mm-hmm, in October. What area are you going to focus on the most this October?
Look, we're still figuring it out, but I think that our key focus would be on the top of the hill, Torre Fabrica, and that large medieval and post-medieval building.
Yeah.
We aim to have volume one of the publication of the Theatre Architecture out early next year. We're working on that at the moment. And increasingly sort of discussions about long-term preservation of the site, working with the Department of Antiquities conservation team, but the integration of Fabrica with the overall Paphos site, which some of our listeners will be aware of, the new bridge.
The monorail?
Yeah.
they're calling it the monorail.
Are they? Yeah. So, but I mean, look, it's architecturally interesting, but what's great about it is that we are now presenting Paphos far more holistically.
Yes.
There's been a whole lot of recent finds in other parts of the town, the functioning modern town, which indicate city walls and other entrances and things like that. So we're getting a far more holistic understanding of the city, and that's exciting. All the different teams working there in the University of Cyprus, we're all working very collaboratively. We've had a whole series of conferences over the last decade, and the next one is planned for Krakow in 2026, I think, from 2025. Wow. So sort of really presenting Paphos holistically. And I think that from that, hopefully we can develop some interesting education resources, both for Cypriots and for visitors to Cyprus. And, obviously our academic reports, but then also producing common language reports because people are interested. And we just need to find the right way to get to them.
Correct.
So part of that is stripping away all the jargon. Makes sense to me, but no one else needs to worry about,
the finer gritty
pre-pottery. The important thing is the patterns that we can see. And it's a very, very exciting time in Cypriot archaeology. The Department of Antiquities is doing a remarkable amount of work on a relatively limited budget. The new museum, when it comes, I think will enable a chance to refocus the way we think about the island's history. And I'm very, very excited about that and very honoured and thrilled to be part of that greater narrative. We always feel so welcomed as guests to the island every time we work there. And it's wonderful to work with colleagues in the department and to work with colleagues in Cyprus more generally. So, and you've been a great facilitator for helping us make some of those patterns over and connections over the years as well.
Well, so thank you. Look, I have to say that it's been an absolute honor, one, to visit you today here in your home base, but it's also been wonderful over the years seeing you and your colleagues and the team over in Cyprus, and including the artists in residence and everyone that's come through in the past, back in the Paphos 2017 exhibition. I'm really looking forward to your next season. I'm looking forward to your publications. I'm looking forward to learning more about my island from my other island. So I'm blessed to live on one of the world's smallest and one of the world's biggest islands, I can't thank you enough. On behalf of the Cypriots, thank you for the work you do there, and we've learned so much from your work there. And obviously to all the other archaeologists and teams in not just Paphos but across the island.
Yes.
We're looking forward to what we will learn next, and looking forward to seeing you in Paphos. I think we can have another chat there. So, listeners, this won't be the last time you hear from Dr. Craig Barker. One more last time, do visit Sydney. Do visit the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney in Camperdown, correct?
That's right.
The Camperdown campus, not far from the centre of the city, so walkable. It's free entry and it is marvellous. You're going to see from ancient Cyprus to the Middle East to Indigenous Australia and to even some modern contemporary works and some animals in jars, as all good museums have. Thank you to Limoncello and the CVAR for being my sponsors. I throw out to the Sarides Library, where I normally record from. Today, for those who can't see, I'm surrounded once again by books, so it seems to follow me. Maybe I need to do a podcast about libraries.
It makes things warmer, doesn't it?
It makes things warmer. Dr. Barker, Craig, thank you so much for the tour today. Thank you so much for recording this podcast with me today, and I look forward to seeing you again soon.
It's my pleasure, Costa. Thank you for having me on.
The first trilingual podcast station of Cyprus. Island Talks. Open. Diverse. Free.